Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, a bunch of very different looks at technology in the hands of the government, good and bad. And let's begin with a really catchy little idea. Let's use technology to really annoy the Germans. We all know how well that works.
Don't let's be beastly to the Germans when our victory is ultimately won.
I can tell you that the president assured the chancellor that the United States is not monitoring and will not monitor the communications of the chancellor.
White House spokesperson Jay Carney in a little duet with Noel Coward there. DEFCON 5 is nuclear war, right? Well, this is DEFCON awkward, the phone call President Obama had to make nice with German Chancellor Angela Merkel about the revelations that Chancellor Merkel's phone has been bugged, under surveillance, has been Snowdened or something by the NSA. President Obama has already had to offer similar reassurances to French President François Hollande when the newspaper Le Monde reported that the communications of French citizens were under U.S. surveillance. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, joins me now. David, welcome.
Good to be with you again, John.
Specifically, what is the U.S. position here? There's not been a denial, but there's been no admission. I don't know what happened. Did Chancellor Merkel's phone actually get bugged here?
Well, the best that we can do, John, is to examine the tense that Jay Carney used, or tenses, in the course of that briefing. He said that Chairman Merkel's phone is not being monitored and will not be monitored. He did not say it had not been monitored. And when we have asked that question, we have gotten no answers. Usually in the case of intelligence cases like this, the question that they don't answer is the most interesting one, and this is no exception. Particularly painful, though, in the case of Germany, which is a huge intelligence partner with the National Security Agency and the rest of the U.S. intel community, was deeply involved in the surveillance of Iran, was deeply involved in the effort to undermine Iran's nuclear centrifuges with a cyber program. So this would be a really awkward one, as you suggest.
And this goes way beyond national security. I mean, the Germans have been hanging in there on the international financial system, on the issues of, holding the euro together and doing the bidding of the U.S. And it just seems to me that politically this is not going to go down well in Germany. What have you heard so far?
Well, it wasn't going down well in Germany, but, you know, we've been through this before. 10 years ago, it was Echelon. There is a little bit of an element here, particularly with the French, of, you know, we are shocked to discover there's espionage in this establishment. Right.
Right.
So, the French do a lot of commercial spying on the United States. The Germans, I'm sure, do spying in the U.S. as well, whether it's of commercial or the government variety, who knows. There's been Mexico and Brazil in the past couple of weeks out of the Snowden revelations. So there's lots going on here.
Yeah, you're very familiar with this. I'm wondering if there are protocols about surveillance of world leaders, particularly if they're allies, if there's anything very specific written down, or is this a kind of a ad hoc situation that when we get the technology, we go, hey, we can do this. Let's do it.
Well, it's more formal than you would think, because with the Five Eyes, the countries that join in the closest intel partnerships with the United States, there are usually formal agreements, especially with Britain, that we don't spy on each other. Now, there was discussion of having such an agreement with France in 2010, and the intelligence agencies in both countries objected. Neither one of them wanted to give up spying on the other. So the idea here that President Hollande or anybody in French intelligence is shocked by the Snowden revelations, well, that's a little much to take. But there are other countries where the U.S. has no such agreement, and both partners with them and spies on them. And, you know, Israel and Germany are good examples.
And, you know, this really relates on a deeper level to the Asian pivot that we haven't heard much about for a whole variety of reasons recently. But I'm wondering how the precedents established here are really going to play out over the long term in East Asia when you're talking about the Chinese and some of the other sort of Asian tigers, Singapore, et cetera, that we're going to need for cooperative arrangements to maintain our national security in the Pacific.
Well, you know, there's no mystery with the Chinese. I mean, we spy on them. They obviously not only spy on us, but take a fair bit of intellectual property and do a fair bit of hacking on the side. That's not going to change. A few partners, close partners like Japan, Singapore, and so forth, that could be, you know, a somewhat different issue. And South Korea, those are the big partners there. And then, of course, Australia and New Zealand are huge intelligence partners, and we you know, usually have agreements with them to keep the spying to a minimum. But frankly, the NSA is a lot more interested in what's going on in the Chinese military than what's going on in Australia.
It sounds like what you're describing is really a, you know, and I hate this metaphor, but, you know, Pandora's box. I mean, it really does seem as though, you know, there's no way really to put this back. We've really entered a fundamentally new age in terms of surveillance, the ease of surveillance, and the extent to which alliances mean only so much.
Well, John, there's an element in which there's nothing new here. People of countries have spied on each other for a long time, and the rise of digital technology just means it's more efficient in doing the spying. What is new is that the U.S. is going to reach a point where it's going to have to make a decision. And I discussed this some with the head of the NSA in an interview that Tom Shanker and I did with him earlier this month. And that fundamental decision is, do you decide that it's more important to have a partner on things like cybersecurity, offensive cyber, than to have a target for surveillance? And I suspect that the U.S. is going to have to make some choices. And those first choices are going to be with Germany and Israel.
Does the NSA want to go down that road? Are they signaling that they're happy about that, or that they want the administration to come up with those things, or what?
This is going to be a political decision for the president. The NSA may have thoughts on it, but the current thoughts may not be as important as the thoughts of, say, General Alexander's successor, General Alexander, who runs the NSA and Cyber Command, has said that he's going to retire by the spring of next year. So the selection of the successor will coincide with this debate.
That's the real takeaway. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. And now to a very different kind of technology problem with the government, the noise over and the problems associated with the online website, front end user interface, enrollment program, call it what you will, for the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare program. It's all escalating. It's a problem of software, branding, and this beta test is proving to be a radioactive gamma ray to the administration right now. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us now. We've got hearings, we've got critics, we've got Democrats who are jumping on the bandwagon here. What's going on, Todd?
Yeah, you've got all those things, and you've even got some tweaks to the individual mandate from the White House itself. That's the big news. Let's get to that first if we can. John, people may have heard, and I just want to put a cap on this really quickly, they may have heard that the Obama administration has delayed the individual mandate. I want to state, not true. They certainly haven't done that. The individual mandate that is so controversial as part of the Affordable Care Act remains in place. But here's what the White House did do last night. Jay Carney, White House press secretary, had forecast this earlier in the week that this might be coming, and then they went ahead and did it. Here's what they did. The end of the open enrollment period. The open enrollment period to sign up for insurance under the Affordable Care Act is October 1st through March 31st. That remains the same. However, there was a deadline in the middle there in February 15th when you would have had to enroll in coverage to avoid the gap under which you would have had to pay a fine if you went too long without insurance under the Affordable Care Act. All they did was they moved that date from February 15th and lined it up with the March 31st that's already in place, which is the end of open enrollment. So those two dates are the same. That means you enroll for coverage by March 31st, no matter what, even if your coverage doesn't kick in until April 1st or April 15th. No fine, no $95 in the first year. That's what the White House did last night.
You're talking fine print there, Todd Zwillick. But basically, even though the administration officials say that this is deadline-related, it's administrative, it's not related to the technical problems with the website, it's certainly going to benefit them to have a longer enrollment period, right?
Look, timing is everything in politics. They say it's not related. They were going to do this anyway. Of course, they had telecast this, that this was coming after problems with healthcare.gov already arose. And if you need to know whether or not the problems with healthcare.gov are a political problem for Democrats, not the White House announcement notwithstanding, let's go down the list now of vulnerable Senate Democrats in red states who are up for re-election, who have come out in the last couple of days, 48 hours in some cases, and said they are for a delay now in the enrollment period, an extension of it anyway. Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire first proposed it. Then you have Pryor of Arkansas, Landrieu of Louisiana, Begich of Alaska, and Hagan of North Carolina, all up in 2014, all Democrats, all saying, yeah, we'd like to extend the open enrollment period because healthcare.gov is too much of a headache for people.
Although, you know, there's plenty of political cover there because extending the enrollment period, which happens a lot when there are software problems in the private sector and the public sector, you know, you ship the product when it's ready and not before. It's different than repealing or defunding. Nobody's saying that on the Democratic side.
There is one Democrat who is saying delay the individual mandate, which has been one of the many Republican positions in the shutdown fight. That person is Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, who has taken a decidedly moderate, sometimes you could say Republican view on parts of the Affordable Care Act. He has proposed and has signed up with Republicans for a delay, but he's one Democrat who so far stands alone. Now, other Democrats are saying nasty things about the administration, saying somebody needs to be fired. One Democratic senator said yesterday that the rollout is a disaster, said another. So Democrats are definitely, John, definitely worried not only that this is going to give a bad brand to the Affordable Care Act, but over in the House, John, the shutdown and debt limit fight has been so damaging to Republicans in terms of the polls, in terms of their brand. Democrats over there are starting to wonder out loud that if this doesn't get fixed and fixed soon, it could completely obviate their chances of taking back the House. And not a lot of people think they can do it, but they think they can get close.
And contractors involved with the Affordable Care Act expressing some frustration of working with the culture of the government. It's not like being in Silicon Valley. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. So amidst the chaos of the Affordable Care Act technology fiasco, another faction of politics may find itself needing to reboot.
The Republican brand is about what I call stewardship. It's thinking forward about what's in the best interests of the country and behaving responsibly in the service of that. And that's not what we're seeing. And it is very upsetting to me and to other Republicans.
That's John Taft, great-grandson of President William Howard Taft. Coming up later this hour on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is sponsored by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. In theaters October 18th.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So the federal government has been dealing with a culture clash regarding the use of technology for some time now. The problems with the Affordable Care Act are just the latest episode in a narrative that has included bad hard drives and obsolete software at the FBI, incompatible systems between departments that need to share data. Well, someone who has seen this culture clash from inside the government and the outside is Clay Johnson, a presidential innovation fellow who now heads up a tech startup called the Department of Better Technology. Clay Johnson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me here.
And congratulations for being a Presidential Innovation Fellow.
You should congratulate me for not being in there right now.
That's the point that we want to get to. There's a very difficult situation trying to manage technology from inside the government. From your perspective, the government is great at dealing with data and getting that out to people in the private sector. But when the government has to do it themselves, it's a different kind of a problem. What are you seeing?
Well, when the government wants to buy technology, government usually fails at it. And by usually, I mean 94% of the time, government's technology purchases, if they're greater than $10 million, end up not working out. That's what came out in the standings group's study of all IT purchases of greater than $10 million just a couple of days ago. 94% of the time when we're buying websites like healthcare.gov, we fail at it. So why do we keep doing it? The reason why we keep doing it is because we've set up internal processes inside of the government that makes us have to do that.
Can I stop you there and just sit?
Sure.
Because from my impression, I'm wondering if the government is viewing a website and a service the same way they view a laptop and a desktop. They think of them as gadgets when really they're much more nuanced than that.
It's much worse than that. Government is viewing technology and a service like they're viewing a battleship and an airplane, and they're building them in the same way. That's really the problem. And the other problem is that because they're doing that and they're used to saying, like, look, only a handful of people in the world can truly build a battleship. Then they only buy websites like they build battleships. They only buy them from a handful of people. And it's not the case that only a handful of people can build a website. When I was inside of the federal government, I had a conversation with another Fed when I was trying to convince them to spend less money on websites. I said, you know, I want to help you buy a website for less than $150,000. The person said, that's impossible. You can't build a website for less than $150,000. I said, sure you can. You can build a website for free. And he said, I would like to see a list of companies that could provide a website for less than $150,000. I said, it's all of them. It's just the people you have never talked to before.
And so let's try to figure out exactly what the government might do differently now. Is it a matter of getting the right team together? Is it a matter of misplaced resources that, you know, we probably do need a few million dollars. It's just put in the wrong place.
Yeah, I think one is we've got to get new people, new and different people on this job to fix healthcare.gov. Obviously, we need for healthcare.gov to be fixed, but you know, the real problem here is the system that was used in order to create healthcare.gov, the federal procurement system, the way that government buys things. Because if we don't fix that, if we don't get together as just the American public and say, hey, member of Congress, we're really interested in the way that this works and we're really interested in this being fixed. If we don't do that, then we're just going to have another healthcare.gov in another year. Last year, we had a bunch of them. The year before that, we had a bunch of them.
Let me just throw this right at you then. I mean, you're a Presidential Innovation Fellow. You're working over there with Todd Park, Chief Technology Officer for the United States government, an Obama favorite. I mean,
he's one of my favorites, too. He's a great guy.
Why can't he get that message out?
He desperately wants to, but look, when you're the CTO of the United States, I think you've got to keep he's not the press secretary, he's not Jay Carney, he's not controlling message, and government's a big place, and there's a lot of people who don't want procurement reform, who don't want to fix the way that government buys things. In fact, I would say most of government is happy the way that the way things are because they don't want to admit that technology has changed the way that they work. And I think we've got to fix that from the outside.
All right, so that's a huge takeaway. So then when these congressional hearings get underway and everybody starts blaming and pointing fingers, really Congress is as much to blame here because they're the ones with a stake in the procurement process, the buying of stuff in every congressional district, the battleships, the $400 million toilets, that whole thing. That's what we're seeing in a different costume.
Well, almost. I mean, the executive branch is in charge of the federal acquisition regulation, although Congress can change it. But you're pointing to the right problem, which is our government has no technical brains. Yes, we've got Todd Park and that kind of thing, but In 1996, during the Republican Revolution, the House of Representatives did away with its sort of technology think tank. It had this think tank that advised Congress on technology. And it basically said, oh, we don't need that anymore. That's superfluous, and got rid of it, which is why time and time again, Congress makes bad technical policy and makes bad technical decisions. They don't have anybody making advising them. Like, they have lawyers to advise them on the law, but they have no one advising them on technology.
So could six guys and three girls with a foosball table in a room with pizza solve this problem? Is that what you're
saying? You know, that's one of these, like, weird things that I think a lot of folks in the media like to report on, is like, oh, it'll just be like three dudes in the garage that can make this thing happen. Look, when you say small business, when I say small business, when I want to see a small business do this, small businesses in the technology sector, government defines them as people who make $25 million, companies who make $25 million a year or less and have less than 50 employees. That's a you know, for you and I, that's a pretty substantially sized business. But, you know, we're talking about professional operations who do professional work for just about every other company in the world except for government.
Wow.
And those are the kinds of people that I'd like to see working inside of the federal government.
Clay Johnson, Presidential Innovation Fellow, who now heads a tech startup called the Department of Better Technology. Thanks, Clay.
Thanks. Thanks for being.
Of course, the big irony in all this discussion of kludgy government technology is that the federal government actually has some really fabulous technology. Okay, maybe not the USS Forrestal supercarrier that was sold for scrap for a penny to a metal recycling company in Texas this week, and maybe not the Angela Merkel bot that listened in on the leader of Germany's telephone calls. Certainly the space program might have some techie delights to share, though. And I don't mean sending all of the bickering politicians and bureaucrats screaming about the Affordable Care Act into near-Earth orbit. Daniel Perez is the CEO of Marbler. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you have a very interesting collaboration going with NASA to try to get some of its technology merged out into the private sector. First of all, what have they got, and how difficult is it to get the goodies inside NASA out into the private sector?
Oh, that's actually a really great question. So NASA, first of all, when it comes to their technology, they have some of the most exciting technology, you know, hate to use a pun, in the galaxy. I mean, they have about $16 billion research budget a year. That's on par with any of the largest corporations you'll ever find out there. And, you know, they're very, very good at solving some incredible problems. They don't just do blue skies research, although they do quite a bit of that, but they develop technologies to solve problems that are facing their astronauts up in space and to help support human life up in space. And very often, a lot of these technologies could potentially have some terrestrial applications.
As we've already seen this hour, the government is actually very good at pushing its big data out to help startups and to assist the private sector. This is more the actual tangible technology and gadgets. Is it a licensing arrangement that you're assisting with, or are you actually re-engineering devices to create fundamentally new products?
Well, it's we're trying to facilitate, the transfer. So while we're not actually getting technically involved with, you know, changing any product per se, what we're trying to do is trying to reimagine the product. So what Marbler does is we post interesting technology from around the world, and we're working with NASA with quite a bit of their technology, so we put this technology out there and we ask anybody from around the world to think of new ways it could be applied, new problems it could solve. For instance, NASA has developed a huge amount of IP and a lot of technologies towards, say, analyzing solar flares or trying to make sense of all the images they're processing out in space. Now, NASA has some of the most brilliant rocket scientists, but they can't be expected to know all the different problems that might exist in different commercial sectors. Or, you know, for instance, some of this image processing software could be used in Hollywood, could be used to process license plates by police forces. And so what we do with Marbler is we put this technology out there that's already patented, and we allow people to chew on it and to say, hey, I would take that laser from NASA and I'd put it in a traffic signal instead to help, you know, allow automobiles to more efficiently traverse the streets.
So the image stabilization stuff that NASA has is even better than the Steadicam stuff that Hollywood's been using for years?
It would put Hollywood to shame. I mean, these guys have developed some of the most impressive image stabilization and video stabilization software out there. But they also have opened up some of their IP around their shuttlecrafts, some IP around some radiation-resistant materials. It's actually really neat, some of the stuff that they've been able to come up with, and we're trying to find out what else could we do with it.
And you're interested in anybody's ideas here. The crowdsourcing is part of the idea.
Yeah. No. So we've had what we try to do with Marble. We try to engage people from around the world. So you don't have to be a scientist. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. Certainly. So this is a high school student who obviously is a little over 16 now, and he's encountering the problem that a lot of us encounter when we live in a cold climate, in that every morning he's got to wait for his windshields to defrost. And so he was thinking, why not incorporate some of this NASA technology to automatically start defrosting his windows? And in fact, he's combined it with some other technology that we have from Korea to allow it, such that it's app-enabled. It knows when his alarm goes off in the morning, and it starts defrosting it, so it's all ready for him by the time he makes it to his to his car. It's actually really clever.
Yeah, and practical. You know, you'd expect time machines from high school students, but no, that's very, very practical. Daniel, thanks so much.
Hey, no worries.
Daniel Perez is CEO of Marbler, a startup that's partnering with NASA to repurpose some of its patented existing technology. Science and technology for the people. That's the spirit. My 12-year-old son is a Minecraft freak. He's really good at building worlds in his favorite online video game, but could he become a Nobel Prize-winning quantum physicist? I wondered that last night as we were trying to remember how many electrons live in the third energy orbital around the nucleus of an atom. Oh, the joys of daddy homework help. I think it's 18. But what if I could elicit Minecraft the game to help with science, the homework, and beyond? Well, a group of scientists, gamers, as you might imagine, folks from Google as well, are retooling Minecraft into a tool for teaching quantum physics. Joining us now, Joel Levin, co-founder of Teacher Gaming and creator of Minecraft EDU. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
So, Joel, how can Minecraft help my 12-year-old learn quantum mechanics?
Well, we've created a special addition to the game called QCraft that adds a number of features to the game world that mimic what's happening in the subatomic world.
And the quantum concepts that are particularly difficult, entanglement, being in two places at one time, or having interactions across galaxies in ways that only quantum physicists understand, mm-hmm. The game can help with this?
Well, it can. It might help to understand if your listeners know a little bit more about Minecraft itself. It presents a world of blocks that looks very much like Legos. And just like Legos, you can build anything with those blocks. And so people build castles and skyscrapers or even whole cities. But one of the beautiful things about Minecraft is that it's incredibly open-ended. Almost anybody with a little programming skills can peek under the hood and change the game to create many other different types of game experiences. So this is something that I've been doing as a teacher for quite a while to add more educational tools into the game itself. So when myself and my partners were approached about using this to make a mod or modification surrounding quantum physics and quantum mechanics and quantum computing, well, it was too good to pass up.
And can you endow the blocks with various properties that actually mimic quantum states, that sort of thing, so that it's not just building worlds, it's actually using these creatures like subatomic particles.
That's exactly it. So we've tried to create behaviors in the game world, in the Minecraft world, that are analogous to what happens on a subatomic level. So, for example, like I said, Minecraft is a world made of blocks. So the example you gave about entanglement, we could have two blocks that could be placed very far apart in the Minecraft world that are still linked. They will exhibit the same behavior. They will change from one state to another. Another concept that we're trying to teach is that of superposition, the idea that a particle can be more than one thing at a time, that depending on who looks at it and how, particles can change their spin or other different states. So we've translated that into the Minecraft world. So a Minecraft block can be both made of stone and wood or other materials at the same time, and they'll exhibit properties of these different materials.
So have you beta tested this on 12-year-olds or even grad students?
Both, and everything in between, and even a certain 7-year-old that lives with me. And the results have been fascinating. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't attempt to teach quantum mechanics from a mathematical or physical sciences level to a younger child. But suddenly, when you transfer these concepts into the world of Minecraft, it becomes much more accessible. You know, gamers are really great at figuring out how systems work and diving deep to be able to do new things in their game. I mean, that's why teachers like myself have been really passionate about bringing games into the classroom, because that's mindset is just really helps nurture an inquisitive mind. So when we're talking about QCraft here, You know, Minecraft players are used to downloading new mods, trying them out, figuring out how they work, figuring out how the systems work. And that's exactly what we've seen our testers doing with QCraft. And of course, the kind of the secret sauce here is that as they're figuring out how these mechanics work, these mechanics are actually present in our universe at the microscopic level.
That's the miracle. And next stop, actually downloading the college credit to go with it. Joel Levin, thanks so much.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Joel Levin, co-founder of Teacher Gaming and creator of Minecraft EDU, which makes an educational version of Minecraft for schools.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
Here's another one for you. Drone technology may be complicating the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. The Washington Post is reporting that Pakistani officials have known about and in some cases explicitly endorsed U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. The CIA's Counterterrorism Center has routinely briefed officials in the Pakistani government on the strikes, targets, and casualty counts. That's a level of cooperation that may come as a surprise to some average Pakistanis.
We have agreed to further strengthen this cooperation. I also brought up the issue of drones in our meeting, emphasizing the need for an end to such strikes.
That's no average Pakistani there. It's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif after a warm and cordial meeting with President Obama this week. Prime Minister Sharif is a vocal critic of the drone program, and yet he has an important stake in maintaining and improving relations with the U.S. With us on the line is Akbar Ahmed, Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. Akbar, welcome to the program.
Great to be back, my friend.
You know, it's always good to talk to you. I'm wondering, domestically in Pakistan, how significant these revelations are.
It's not particularly explosive because people have long suspected it. And in fact, if you recall a couple of months ago, President Musharraf admitted it. He admitted to being complicit in the drone program. What is significant in this visit of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to Washington is the fact that it took place at all. Relations between the two countries and the two countries need to be in a situation of mutual cooperation, mutual alliance for mutual benefits. The relationship has been on a downward spiral, and this visit has halted that spiral and, I suspect, even turned it around. So the atmosphere was cordial. It was understanding. There was a lot of empathy on both sides, and there was not much of a fuss about the drone program.
Although, how can Nawaz Sharif project that he is opposed to the drone program and yet admit and acknowledge that Pakistani officials are briefed beforehand when drone strikes take place?
You're right. It puts him in a very awkward position because he has publicly said before the elections and after becoming prime minister that he will stop the use of the drone in the territories of Pakistan. And Imran Khan, another very prominent politician in Pakistan, actually said the day I become prime minister, I'll order the Pakistan Air Force to shoot down the drones. So you can see the emotions are very, very high in Pakistan about this program, which in a sense has become symbolic of all that is wrong in the relationship between America and Pakistan, and that is why it is such a crucial issue. Now, Nawaz Sharif has to go back and convince the people of Pakistan to have more patience, to tackle the scourge of the militants, the suicide bombers and so on, and tackle that seriously and focus on economic development and somehow persuade Pakistanis that the drone program tacitly will be either slowed down or even suspended for the time being.
Do you think there's a call on the part of the military within Pakistan to get its own drone program, forget the U.S., to actually share that technology with the Pakistanis?
Well, you know, this is a concern of mine, which I raised in my book, The Thistle and the Drone, which is about this whole business of drones being used in tribal societies, that very soon, although the United States has taken the lead in this, very soon there will be many, many countries around the world with their own drone programs. And it's not very difficult to put up, fly up in the air. And they would then be risking crossing international borders. You'll have all sorts of incidents between neighbors. And it really is a frightening scenario in the future. So this whole episode, focused on Pakistan as it is, should give us pause for thought and say, where are we going into the 21st century in the next couple of decades?
Let's also look ahead on the transition that's going to take place next year in Afghanistan. I'm wondering how much the U.S. needs Pakistan to be on board with it, to be cooperative with it, to put aside political differences between the Afghan government, whatever it should be, and the Pakistani government to make sure that that transition is peaceful.
Very important. And that is why you're seeing a complete change in tone from Washington. Secretary Kerry, who met Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, we all Pakistani community leaders had dinner with the Prime Minister on the 21st, and he shared this with us in speaking informally. He said, I met Secretary Kerry the night before and the head of the CIA and the Secretary of Defense. And he said this. He said that, in fact, Secretary Kerry underlined how important Pakistan is for the United States. It's not only the drawdown, but look into the future. Once America leaves Afghanistan, and I hope not completely, it still needs a strong foothold there, because that region is vital to American political interests, geopolitical, economic interests. That is, on the one side, you have China, you have India in the south, you have Central Asia in the north, the Arab world and Iran to the west. America has to be there. And what is the route into Afghanistan? It is Pakistan.
Akbar Ahmed, I happen to know that on occasion you have the ear of Prime Minister Sharif, and he listens to you as well. Without violating any confidences here, does he think the Afghan elections are going to go well, or the Taliban, will they be able to scuttle this transition?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure he or any political figure listens to me at all. Your scholars on campus, just have to say what they have to say. But he was aware in the talk he gave us. He talked in Urdu, which is more informal than a prepared English text, which he put aside. He talked about the problems in that neighborhood. Remember, he's got Afghanistan on one side and India on the other side. He talked very soberly. He talked about the importance of setting our own house in order. He talked to Pakistanis saying, we always blame outsiders. You know, Pakistanis are very quick to blame Americans or Indians for all the problems of Pakistan. He said, no, the time has come to be very self-reflective, to look at ourselves and say, who is responsible for this mess?
Akbar Ahmed is chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom, author of the book The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War on Tribal Islam. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thinking about technology this hour, some technology that actually works very well and is growing is our website, thetakeaway.org. And our rollout more than 5 years ago was a moment I don't care to revisit, but all that's fixed. Go to thetakeaway.org. As we get into the holidays, there are going to be so many ways for listeners to be involved. Our growing number of stations you can see on the map. It's all at thetakeaway.org. And if you want to share a story about something 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Is the Republican Party itself evolving right now? Has the GOP reloaded its software and come up with an ideological, barn-burning upgrade to replace the Republican rhetoric of, say, the Eisenhower era, the Nixon era, or even the Reagan era? Is this GOP 4.0 going on right now? Well, it's about as welcome to some in the Republican Party as the Obamacare website is to the Tea Party. John Taft is one of the GOP faithful who is not happy right now. He's the great-grandson of our 27th president, William Howard Taft. He actually calls himself a genetic Republican. And he recently expressed his outrage about the tone of the party right now in the pages of The New York Times. John Taft, welcome.
Hello, John.
Now, you write in your op-ed piece in The New York Times and have stated this before, that you feel like a genetic Republican, that you're basically hardwired to be a Republican. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that I am the scion of a legacy of five generations of Republicans who have served the country. And I literally feel like I would be committing a sin if I were to renounce my Republican heritage. So it's in my DNA is what I mean by saying I'm a genetic Republican.
Now, why would you expect the Republican Party to stay with the principles of your great-grandfather? I mean, there have been a lot of twists and turns in American politics. Certainly the Democrats have gone a very different way regarding, say, relations with African Americans, and the Republicans similarly.
Absolutely. You would expect, and in fact, you would want any organization, including the Republican Party, to evolve over time. But what I was trying to reflect in my op-ed piece was my own intuition about where the Republican brand is. In other words, where the Republican Party still is positioned in the psyche of the American people. And it's my opinion that the Republican brand is about what I call stewardship. It's thinking forward about what's in the best interests of the country and behaving responsibly in the service of that. And that's what I think Republicans like me want to see reflected in the behavior of our political leaders, our Republican political leaders, and that's not what we're seeing, and it is very upsetting to me and to other Republicans.
Of course, the Tea Party folks say we're taking back the country. We have the interests of the United States at heart. Obamacare is a catastrophe. I mean, it's a little hyperbole, but they're using the same kind of language that you're talking about there.
Well, I don't think they're using the same kind of language at all. As I say in the article, the op-ed piece, it's a bomb-throwing, oppositional type of language, and it is about as far away from the language of responsible stewardship as you can get. And this generation of Republicans has accomplished what no previous generation of Republicans has been able to do, and that is to position the Democratic Party as the party of fiscal responsibility. That is ground that we have occupied or should be occupying throughout the history of the Republican Party, and we've ceded that as a result of the tactics you're seeing deployed in Congress right now.
Now, John Taft, you could make the argument that there hasn't been a Republican in the mold that you describe really since Richard Nixon. And let's put his sort of Watergate problems aside for a moment. But in principle terms, Nixon was the last president in that Republican mold. Ronald Reagan threw bombs at Washington coming in the 1980s. I think the discussions that took place under Newt Gingrich, the kinds of confrontations that took place in the 90s reflect a very different sort of Republican set of principles from Richard Nixon. This is maybe a really, really old story, and these guys in the Tea Party are just continuing something that's been going on since the 80s.
I was a newspaper reporter, if you can believe that, back in the day when Ronald Reagan was running for president, and wrote the same kind of thing you just said in a couple of pieces, including one when I recovered the Republican convention in Kansas City. I think that Ronald Reagan, the candidate, was something of a bomb thrower. I did not like him. I think Ronald Reagan, president of the United States, governed very differently than he ran, and he was a responsible, surprisingly centrist Republican. And I do not think that Ronald Reagan would approve of the tactics that we're seeing deployed in Congress today. But it's ironic because the Tea Party does invoke him as one of their father figures. He was willing to cut deals, and he was willing to compromise in the service of putting into place solutions that are, you know, still effective to this day.
John Taft, if you look in your family history and family album, you know very, very well that when Teddy Roosevelt came in, even though some of the progressive principles of Teddy Roosevelt began under your great-grandfather, William Howard Taft, the Republican Party went through an extraordinary change, and so did the Democratic Party, for that matter. Do you think there's a real shift taking place in both parties as moderates are looking for a home, the progressives on the sort of Democratic side looking for a home, and the language you're seeing in the Tea Party also, orphaned ideologues looking for a home?
Yeah, in my opinion, here's what's going on. We are entering, if we're not already in, a new era in American history when the average linear 3% compounded annual growth that we've experienced since the Industrial Revolution is being replaced by economic growth rates closer to 0%. When we're looking at resource scarcity, when we're looking at issues of environmental change, there simply aren't as many chips to spread around the table. So when one side wants something, they have to take a chip away from the other side. It is a win-lose situation today in a low-growth environment. When Gingrich cut a deal with Clinton, there was enough money to go around so that they could both get a little bit of what they wanted. That's not possible today. Obama gets something, it comes away from Boehner. Boehner gets something, it comes away from Obama. And in that kind of environment, it is much harder to get to deals. The sad thing is that the problems facing this country right now can all be addressed if our political leaders would behave like responsible stewards and work together to address them. That's the tragedy. These are not intractable problems for the United States, but we have to have responsible behavior at the level of Congress and the administration to take care of them, and we're not seeing that.
John Taft, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
John Taft is the great-grandson of President William Howard Taft, CEO of RBC Management USA, and the author of Stewardship: Lessons Learned from the Lost Culture of Wall Street. Well, there you have it. Government, hardware, software, technology, ideology, and we've spent another hour together. Got a tech government story? Have you listened in on a foreign leader's phone call? We'd love to hear about that. Tell us how you're feeling about the state of politics today. Seriously, you can give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And, you know, you can be a part of our listener response network. You sign up for texts. We ask you a question featured on the next day's show, and you can start the conversation. Text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.